In an era when heroes seem increasingly rare, we told Pilecki's extraordinary story stands as a testament to the heights of human courage. This Polish cavalry officer voluntarily allowed himself to be arrested and sent to Auschwitz in 1940, not as an act of martyrdom, but as a deliberate mission to gather intelligence and organize resistance from the most notorious death camp in history. His story remained largely unknown until the fall of communism in Poland, when his classified reports and memoirs finally emerged from Soviet archives. Today, historians consider Pilecki's detailed accounts among the earliest and most important evidence of Nazi atrocities, while his moral courage represents one of the most remarkable acts of heroism during World War II. As Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel once remarked upon learning of Pilecki's story, "This is the history of a man who volunteered to be imprisoned in Auschwitz. I repeat, who volunteered. I didn't know such a man existed." We told Pilecki's journey began in August 1939, when this 38-year-old reserve officer and landowner received mobilization orders as German troops massed on Poland's border. With just 48 hours to gather his 90 volunteers, mostly peasants with limited military experience, he prepared to defend his homeland against Hitler's imminent invasion. After bidding farewell to his wife Maria and their two children, promising to return in 2 weeks, Pilecki led his men westward into what would become a devastating defeat. The Polish defense collapsed quickly against Germany's superior military might. Pilecki's unit was decimated at Wobors, his horse Bajka killed beneath him as German panzers overwhelmed their position. With just a dozen survivors, he made his way to Warsaw, only to find the government had already fled. When Soviet forces invaded from the east in late September, completing Poland's partition, Pilecki refused to surrender. Instead, he joined Major Jan Wodarkiewicz to form the Tajna Armia Polska, secret Polish army, conducting underground resistance activities in occupied Warsaw. Throughout the harsh winter of 1939-1940, Pilecki served as chief recruiter for this nascent resistance network, carefully selecting members while gathering intelligence through contacts in the Polish police. Despite Governor Hans Frank's escalating executions of resistance members, Pilecki's group grew to nearly 100 men by December. They targeted collaborators, particularly ethnic German informants who helped Nazis identify different Polish groups. By summer 1940, tensions emerged between Pilecki and Wodarkiewicz over the latter's increasingly right-wing anti-Semitic ideology. When Wodarkiewicz prepared a manifesto declaring Poland has to be Christian, with those opposed removed from our lands, Pilecki worked behind his back to align with Colonel Stefan Rowecki's more inclusive resistance group. This conflict came to a head when Wodarkiewicz asked Pilecki to volunteer for an extraordinarily dangerous mission, infiltrating Auschwitz to gather intelligence and organize resistance within. Though initially hesitant about abandoning his family and risking his life, Pilecki ultimately agreed. On September 19, 1940, he deliberately allowed himself to be captured during a German roundup in Warsaw's Zolibor's district. As German soldiers took him away, he whispered to his sister-in-law, "Report back that the order is done." Pilecki was transported with hundreds of other prisoners to a horse barracks, then loaded onto freight trains bound for Auschwitz. We told arrived at Auschwitz on September 21, 1940, after a nightmarish journey packed into a freight car with 60 others. The prisoner's introduction to the camp was immediate brutality. Guards shot 11 men as an example, claiming one had tried to escape. As they entered through the infamous Arbeit macht frei, work sets you free, gate, SS Obersturmfuhrer Fritz Zeidler informed them bluntly that none would leave alive, as rations were calculated to sustain them for only 6 weeks. The processing stripped prisoners of their humanity. We told became number 4859, had his head and body shaved with blunt blades, lost 2 teeth when struck for not holding his ID card correctly, and was issued an ill-fitting striped uniform with wooden clogs. In the dawn light, he could finally see the camp layout. barracks arranged around a parade ground, with a single strip of barbed wire forming the enclosure and guard posts positioned every few hundred feet. Life in the camp followed a brutal routine. Each morning began with kapos beating anyone slow to rise, followed by rushed latrine visits at an open trench and fights for access to a single water cistern. Roll call included the deputy commandant declaring, "Your Poland is dead forever," pointing to the crematorium chimney as their only way to freedom. New arrivals spent hours practicing military drills and performing punishing exercises at the kapos whim. The environment systematically destroyed normal human bonds, turning prisoners mistrustful and aggressive. Food became the camp's currency, with new arrivals exploited before they understood its value. As a room supervisor responsible for distributing the thin barley soup at lunch, Witold immediately recognized the power this position gave him as every eye followed his ladle. Witold quickly realized his initial plan of staging a breakout was naive. His new priority became alerting Warsaw to the camp conditions, hoping the British would retaliate once informed. But first, he needed to find someone he could trust to help get a message beyond the walls. Through careful observation, he began identifying potential recruits based on small acts of altruism, forming a core five that included his Warsaw colleagues and hospital workers. Despite the crushing conditions designed to eliminate all human solidarity, Witold methodically built a resistance network within Auschwitz. His recruitment strategy was brilliantly simple yet effective. He watched for small acts of kindness or moral courage amid the brutality, then carefully approached these individuals. Each member would know only those in their immediate cell, with Witold as the sole person aware of the entire network. The evening promenade along the fence became Witold's recruitment ground. Some, like his colleague Kon Piekarski, initially doubted the effort but eventually joined. As the camp expanded rapidly through the winter of 1940-1941, Witold struggled with hunger and physical deterioration while searching for ways to send reports to Warsaw. Through his colleague Misha, he identified Alexander Wielopolski, a soon-to-be-released prisoner, as a potential messenger. By February 1941, Witold had recovered enough from illness to move around the camp on underground business while still officially a hospital patient. His network had grown to over 100 men across most work details, influencing kapos with small bribes and placing recruits in positions of power. As the camp expanded, there were constant openings for kapos that German prisoners couldn't fill, allowing Witold's men to secure better positions. A crucial breakthrough came when Dr. Daring arranged for a radio to be stolen and hidden under the floorboards in an office, connected through a cleverly disguised wire. This allowed Witold and Daring to secretly listen to BBC broadcasts, gathering crucial information about the war that Witold selectively shared to boost prisoner morale. By spring 1941, Witold had increased recruitment, growing his underground force to several hundred men. Though the SS suspected underground activity, they assumed prisoners had merely formed gangs rather than recognizing Witold's organized resistance movement. Witold maintained security by ensuring he was the only one who knew everyone in the network, though his cover was nearly blown several times when friends used his real name or when SS officers questioned his identification photo. The resistance employed creative methods against their captors. When Witold identified a likely Gestapo agent among his recruits, rather than killing him outright, they dosed him with croton oil, had him sent to the hospital, and tricked SS doctors into approving his execution for acute meningitis. Later, they weaponized typhus-infected lice, with prisoners like Teddy the Boxer planting vials in SS coat collars at the German hospital. They targeted specific SS men, including Dr. Schwelle, who oversaw the phenol injection program, and camp executioner Gerhard Politzich. In late 1941, Witold's underground network began documenting a horrifying shift in Auschwitz's purpose. Initially established as a concentration camp for Polish political prisoners, it was transforming into something far more sinister. In September 1941, we told witness the first experimental gassing when SS guards modified the penal block by sealing basement windows. Nearly 250 sick prisoners and Soviet POWs were selected and carried to the basement cells. The next morning, nurses reported the gassing of 850 men using Zyklon B, describing corpses packed so tightly they remained standing, with bluish skin and bulging eyes. A week later, we told observed SS guards herding naked men into the crematorium, where they were gassed through specially drilled holes in the roof. Though he recognized the efficiency of killing victims beside the ovens, he couldn't yet comprehend the ideology of industrial mass murder, assuming the Soviets were killed merely because no accommodation was ready. By spring 1942, the camp's transformation accelerated dramatically. Witold's network witnessed the first mass gassing of Jews in the main camp crematorium, where SS Untersturmführer Maximilian Grabner deceived them with promises of disinfection before sealing them in and dropping poison through roof vents while a truck engine drowned out their screams. The gassings continued, with about 10,000 Jews murdered in May alone, until the crematorium's chimney cracked from overheating. The SS then shifted operations to a red brick farmhouse in the woods near Birkenau, where they bricked up windows, reinforced doors, and installed a gas chamber. By July 1942, Himmler ordered entire Jewish families sent to the camp, with workers selected upon arrival and everyone else, mothers, children, the elderly, gassed immediately. A second farmhouse, the White House, was converted into a gas chamber, enabling the SS to exterminate 2,000 Jews at once. Witold's network meticulously documented these atrocities. Their recruits in the records office made copies of the Starke book, daily count book, during night shifts, revealing that of 30,000 Poles registered in the camp, only 11,132 remained alive by March 1942. Most Polish Jews brought to the camp were dead, and of 12,000 Soviet POWs, barely 100 survived. By mid-July 1942, Witold's network had documented 35,000 Jewish deaths in just 2 months. "We have strayed dreadfully," Witold wrote. "We have become a whole level of hell worse than animals." As Witold documented the escalating genocide, he desperately tried to get this information to the Allies. His first reports reached Warsaw through Alexander Wielopolski, who was released in October 1940. Alexander delivered Witold's camp report to underground leaders who recognized its value as evidence of German crimes violating the 1907 Hague Convention. The report included Witold's plea: "The prisoners beg the Polish government, for the love of God, to bombard these warehouses to end their torment and create an opportunity for escape. Should they die in the attack, it would be a relief given the conditions." To get this report to London, they enlisted noblewoman Julia Lubomirska, who delivered it to Stanislaw Radziwi at the League of Nations, who arranged for it to reach Polish Prime Minister Sikorski in London around December 1940. In London, Sikorski struggled against British stereotypes and condescension while facing the challenge of making Polish atrocities stand out when Britain itself was under devastating attack from Hitler's Blitz. When Witold's bombing request reached RAF Bomber Command, Air Chief Marshal Charles Portal rejected it, writing that an attack was an undesirable diversion and unlikely to achieve its purpose with the limited bombs available. As Auschwitz evolved into a death camp, Witold engineered more escapes to deliver updated information. In May 1942, he selected Wincenty Gavron and Stefan Bielecki to escape and report the systematic murder of Jews. After their successful escape, they traveled to Warsaw, where Stefan delivered Witold's report to the underground headquarters in late June. Despite these efforts, Allied response remained minimal. When Jewish politician Shmuel Ziegelbaum pleaded for bombing of Auschwitz and SS units in the Warsaw Ghetto, both British and American authorities refused to act. On May 11, 1943, following the ghetto's destruction, Ziegelbaum committed suicide in despair, leaving a note expressing his most profound protest against the inaction as the world permitted the destruction of the Jewish people. The most promising opportunity came when underground leader Rowecki selected Napoleon Segeda, a 32-year-old SOE-trained agent, to witness the camp firsthand and then travel to London as a credible messenger. Napoleon set off for Auschwitz around July 18, 1942, and received smuggled reports documenting the mass murder of Jews. Though he correctly concluded Auschwitz had become a continent-wide extermination center for Europe's Jews, Napoleon remained stranded in Switzerland for months, waiting for travel documents that never arrived. By early 1943, with mounting frustration over the Allies' silence and witnessing his carefully built resistance network being systematically dismantled by increasingly aggressive SS crackdowns, Witold Pilecki began formulating his escape strategy. His initial reconnaissance involved dangerous nighttime explorations of the camp's extensive sewer system, but after weeks of careful mapping, he concluded the tunnels offered no viable exit route due to newly installed grating and routine patrols. The breakthrough came through his connection with fellow inmates Edmund Zabowski and Jan Rejay, who proposed an ambitious plan centered around the camp's external bakery facility. Jan, who had earned a coveted position on the bread delivery detail, initially suggested a daylight escape using stolen bicycles from the SS garage. However, Witold, drawing on his military experience, recognized that the night shift would provide crucial cover and fewer guards, despite presenting its own set of complex challenges. The obstacles seemed insurmountable at first. 3 sets of locked doors, rotating guard patrols every 15 minutes, and an external steel latch that required specialized tools to remove. Yet methodically, like a military operation, they addressed each challenge. Jan ingeniously created perfect impressions of both the door key and the specialized nut securing the latch using stolen bread dough, allowing Witold to coordinate with camp metal workers to fabricate exact replicas. Getting assigned to the bakery detail required elaborate staging. Witold carefully mimicked typhus symptoms, including self-induced fever through excessive exercise and deliberate sleep deprivation. His friend Edek, working in the hospital administration, orchestrated his admission while skillfully avoiding the mandatory medical inspection that would have exposed the ruse. When Witold revealed his escape plans, Edek, inspired by the audacity and recognizing his own increasing danger as a resistance member, committed to joining the operation. Their manipulation of the camp's bureaucracy proved masterful. Through Edek's careful documentation and strategic use of limited medical supplies as bribes, they secured official release papers from the hospital. The bakery assignment required further finesse. They gradually won over the Kapo's cooperation through an elaborate system of bribes, including rare luxuries like fresh apples, sugar rations, and precious jam obtained through the resistance network. On the stormy night of April 26, 1943, they marched with the bakery squad past the infamous Arbeit macht frei gate. Witold, walking beneath those cynical words one final time, made a silent vow that would haunt him for years. Never again would he pass under that gate of death. The night shift proceeded normally until midnight, when a heart-stopping moment occurred. A guard conducted an unscheduled inspection, but failed to notice the carefully loosened bolts and disabled telephone lines. Their actual escape unfolded like a carefully choreographed dance. They burst through the prepared door during a thunderclap, sprinting toward the Sola River through the darkness. The railway bridge crossing proved especially harrowing, forcing them to time their movements between searchlight sweeps. After miles of exhausting travel along the riverbank, they discovered an abandoned fishing boat, which they used to cross the broader Vistula River. As dawn broke, they finally reached the safety of a dense forest, where they collapsed in exhaustion. Witold later wrote that the profound silence of the forest seemed almost supernatural compared to the constant cacophony of the camp where he had spent what felt like 1,000 years of his life. After his escape, Witold returned to Warsaw in August 1943, nearly 3 years after volunteering for Auschwitz. His first priority was reconnecting with his wife Maria and children, though he remained focused on convincing the underground leadership to authorize an attack on Auschwitz. Despite his conviction that his plan was militarily sound, a diversionary attack followed by a camp uprising, underground leaders rejected it, explaining that they needed to preserve resources for a nationwide revolt when German forces retreated. Devastated by this failure, Witold began writing a new report about Auschwitz that departed from his previous military-style accounts. This time he included scenes, thoughts, and impressions, the sights, sounds, and smells of the camp, hoping to connect readers to its moral universe. "Perhaps some families can then find images of their loved ones in my story," he wrote. "This is why I write." When the Warsaw Uprising began on August 1, 1944, Witold joined the fighting, surviving the 63-day battle that ended in defeat with over 130,000 dead, mostly civilians. Captured and sent to a POW camp in Germany, he was liberated by American forces in May 1945. Though some prisoners left immediately, Witold felt bound by his oath to fight the Soviets and waited for orders from the Polish government in exile. In July 1945, he was summoned to Italy to join General Anders' Second Corps. There, haunted by camp memories, Witold began writing another report, this time allowing himself to express emotions. "We were not made of wood, let alone stone. One still had a heart beating." By October, he had completed 104 typed pages of his manuscript, which he entrusted to the Polish ambassador to the Vatican before departing on a new mission, returning to Soviet-occupied Poland to organize resistance against the communist regime. This decision proved fatal. In May 1947, Witold was arrested by Poland's communist secret police and subjected to brutal torture. Beatings with a metal ruler, tearing out hair, pulling off fingernails, burning with cigarettes, and tightening a metal band around his head until he fainted. Despite this, at his March 1948 show trial, we told the court, "I tried to live my life in such a fashion so that in my last hour I would rather be happy than fearful. I find happiness in knowing that the fight was worth it." Sentenced to death, his appeals were denied despite petitions from former Auschwitz prisoners. On May 25, 1948, at sunset, Witold was taken to a small building on the prison grounds where executioner Piotr Smiatonski shot him in the back of the head. In the years following Witold's execution, Poland's communist government launched a systematic campaign of repression, arresting over 80,000 underground resistance members and deliberately branding his family as enemies of the state. Maria, his widow, was forced into a life of anonymity, finding work as a cleaner in a church orphanage, a dramatic fall for the wife of a resistance hero. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Józef Sienkiewicz, who had survived Auschwitz himself, orchestrated an official historical narrative that prominently featured communist inmates while deliberately minimizing both Witold's contributions and the broader Holocaust tragedy. This selective retelling served the regime's political aims of emphasizing communist resistance while suppressing non-communist heroism. The systematic erasure of Witold's legacy began to crack in the 1960s when underground leader Tadeusz Pachinski made a crucial decision to share Witold's detailed reports with historian Josef Garlinski. This led to Garlinski's groundbreaking 1975 book, Fighting Auschwitz, which became the first serious documentation of Witold's extraordinary mission. The book, though limited in circulation, kept Witold's memory alive during the communist era. The fall of the Soviet Union in 1989 marked a turning point in uncovering Witold's full story. His son Andrei, working alongside historian Adam Tsaira, gained unprecedented access to a treasure trove of documents, complete intelligence reports, Witold's personal memoir, and his haunting interrogation files from communist prisons. These documents revealed not just the scope of his resistance activities, but also the brutal nature of his persecution. Cyrus' comprehensive 2000 Polish biography finally established Witold as a national hero in Poland, though his remarkable story remained largely unknown internationally for another decade. Witold's detailed documentation provides an invaluable historical record of Auschwitz's evolution from a concentration camp into an industrial killing center. His reports stand out for their unflinching detail and moral clarity. While many officials in both Warsaw and London who received his reports chose to minimize or dismiss the horror he described, Witold insisted on bearing witness regardless of personal risk or political convenience. Though his strong Polish nationalist identity sometimes narrowed his perspective on the Holocaust's unique significance as the war's defining tragedy, these same patriotic convictions provided the moral foundation that sustained his dangerous mission. His remarkable capacity to build trust networks in an environment designed to destroy human bonds became a powerful form of resistance, allowing prisoners to maintain dignity and humanity even in the face of death. The final tragic irony of Witold's life was that he died believing his mission had ultimately failed to alert the world to Auschwitz's horrors. Yet today, his story serves as one of history's most powerful testimony to moral courage in confronting systematic evil. His final memoir reflection on his dying friends in Auschwitz captures the essence of his legacy. They regretted only not giving enough to other people, of their hearts, of the truth. Through his own sacrificial life and death, Witold Pilecki embodied this highest form of human devotion to truth and service to others.